Please welcome my guest, the man that gravity forgot, the new sensation, Neville. The new sensation.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I endorse that as Neville's new music. Who's with me? This is episode 381 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, May 3rd, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody's having a great weekend. Last night, the big Floyd Mayweather-Manny Pacquiao fight that cost people $100 unless you went and found a stream, which I think the entire world was trying to do last night. I got no less than 5 messages from people asking me if I had a stream, which I did not. But I did hear about the fight. I heard it was okay. And the outcome, not really that much of a surprise. If I had to pick a winner going in, I had called Mayweather, I think as most people probably did. And Mayweather won. So he is now 48-0. I think he's got one fight left, and supposedly then he'll retire. Although we've heard that from lots of wrestlers before. Probably boxers, I would imagine, are the same. They say they'll retire. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the pay-per-view industry and the boxing industry hoping that he has a change of heart. This is probably going to go down as the biggest money pay-per-view match, boxing match, fight, anything, you just name it. This is bigger than all of them. They made so much money last night, it's disgusting. And the other kind of little bit of fallout from this, on a much smaller scale, not that this is a big deal, but I did notice the tweet from Michelle Beadle of ESPN, who's a big WWE super fan, or was. She sent a tweet out saying, "I've loved WWE for a long time, but Triple H and his love for a serial abuser is too much. I'm turning in my fan card, hashtag fun while it lasted." So apparently Michelle Beadle no longer a fan of WWE. I guess that means that Michelle Beadle won't be covering much of the NFL anymore either for ESPN, if that's her criteria that she wants to use for situations like this. She was upset also, you know, she was upset because her and Rachel Nichols, who is a sports reporter now for CNN, I think she used to be with ESPN, her and Rachel Nichols were banned by the Mayweather people from being credentialed for the fight last night because of how outspoken the two of them have been about Floyd Mayweather's issues with domestic abuse, which are very well documented. Floyd Mayweather is a scumbag. We know this. The guy's a piece of crap. And I do think it's weird how infatuated Triple H seems to be with Mayweather given his past. He's always tweeting words of support. He's been in Mayweather's corner in the past. Of course, Mayweather came in to do the angle with Big Show, which was a great angle. And I'm not taking anything away from Floyd as a performer, a boxer, anything like that. The guy's great. And that angle, that initial angle they shot at that No Way Out pay-per-view back in 08, when the Big Show came back all slimmed down, that was a great angle. That may have been, if not the best, one of the best celebrity angles they've ever done. An angle, by the way, that they cut the commentary out for, so there was no announcing. They just kind of let it breathe. Sometimes not having any commentary can actually do a world of good. I wish they would take that advice more often with their commentary team these days. But anyway, so it is a little weird to see how infatuated Triple H is with this guy considering his past. I mean, it's not like it's an isolated incident. The guy has a documented history of beating the shit out of women. He's gone to jail for it. You know, it's creepy how people can so easily ignore this just because there's no leaked video on TMZ. You know, Ray Rice is another piece of shit, but we actually got to see the video of him dragging his unconscious fiancée out of an elevator, so he must be the most evil man in the world. How can you possibly compare him to Money Mayweather? know, it all boils down to money. You know, it's in the guy's name, money, right? The guy made more money in one night than WWE will probably make all year. He made more in one night than any athlete will make in a year. Money talks. That's just the reality of it. And he made a shitload of money for himself. He made a shitload of money for a lot of people last night. And that's all that matters. That's all they care about. I wish more people like her would bring this up every time this clown is out in public. But yeah, I do find it suspect, I have to say, that she apparently had no problem going to the fight. She was planning on going to the fight and covering the fight until she found out that she wasn't credentialed. Then she decided to pitch a fit and go cover something else. Like it was some form of protest. So Michelle Beadle is no longer a fan of WWE. Somewhere in Chicago, AJ Lee, I'm sure, is smiling. Thank you to everybody who has used our Audible link to sign up for a free trial of the service this week. Keep on doing it. We are now in the month of May, so we have started anew, and we need to build up some signups for the month of May. So if you've never done it before, if you are not familiar with Audible.com, you can use our custom URL to sign up for a free trial. You can sample the service for 30 days. It is an audiobook service. Use audibletrial.com. Some of you are using the wrong URL. It's not audible.com or it's audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Punch in that URL. It'll register almost like a code. From there, you have to go through the sign-up process, the normal sign-up process, whatever it is. And at that point, you then get to cash in one free audiobook on us. It's free for you. Our gift to you. And they've got tons of books. Not every single book is on there, but a lot of them are. They've got 150,000 plus titles, a lot of wrestling books, sports books, self-help books, novels, sci-fi, crime, I mean, all that stuff. So you get a free audiobook out of it, and if you want to cancel and you don't like the service or you don't really see a need for it, you can cancel anytime in those 30 days. You won't be billed, and you get to keep your free book. It's a great deal. So go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Try out the service and get your free audiobook on us. If you like what you hear each week, please consider making a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a shout-out and a wrestling nickname. $30 or more. And beyond the nickname, you get a quick plug for your own podcast, if you have one, or a business, or what have you. Just include that information when you make the donation. Thank you this week to Out of Control Cody Thomas, Malicious Intent, Michael Cuomo, David Sold Out Solus, Light 'Em Up, Lamont Ambler, Luke, I Don't Need Rehab, Roland, he doesn't need rehab, Edward the Wolf, Witherington, Save the World, Sean Tilly, No Pain, No Gain, Michael Sanford, The Washington Heights Bad Boy, Harry Singletary, Jason Apple Smash Ahrens, and Feisty Fred Feltner, whose Kayfabe Connection podcast drops each and every Monday on iTunes. You can also check it out at kayfabeconnection.com. Check it out. It's pretty good. So thank you to everybody who made a donation. Again, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. It is the most direct, easiest, best, preferred way to contribute and show your support for The Sound Off. And you can do so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That box is always there, sitting there on the right-hand side. ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off is our official store on Pro Wrestling Tees. We have up to 5XL on all of our shirts. They ship all over the world. And I got to give a shout out to one of our PayPal donators, actually, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan. He tweeted me a photo. It was so freaking cool. It must have been from some kind of convention, I guess, this weekend. He met Jerry the King Lawler. And he was wearing our official Sound Off Shitty the Announcer t-shirt, which is really more directed towards Michael Cole than anything else. And so there's Eugene, or at least I think it was Eugene, sitting there with the Shitty the Announcer shirt. Next to him is Jerry the King Lawler with a big grin on his face, giving the thumbs up to the shirt. It was quite the priceless photo, and I think maybe part of the meaning of it also went over his head. So that just makes the photo even better. So I have to thank him for that shot. And hey, anybody out there who, whether it's that shirt or any of the other 18 shirts that we have in our store right now and more to come in the future, if you have a great photo that you want to snap with a wrestler that you meet or somebody, by all means, snap that photo and send it to me, and I'll be more than happy to retweet it and give you a shout-out here on the show. That one was just the photo of the week. That was priceless. You can find it. It's on my Twitter and on Facebook as well. I also posted, by the way, I was digging out some old stuff here in my room, and I I found my very first piece of hate mail that I ever received back when I was writing a wrestling column for the local newspaper here in New York. I got originally it started out as an internship, and I was with them for several years. I was the first person to bring a wrestling column to the paper, and so it was kind of a regular, recurring thing. This is back around 1998, 99, 2000, you know, in that area. And I wrote a column early in 2000 called Overstepping the Bounds of Objectivity, and it was, you know, I directed aim at one Phil Mushnick, that stooge from the New York Post, who seems to have a hard-on for Vince McMahon and WWE for the last 25 years. And honestly, off the top of my head, I don't remember exactly what the nature of my gripe was with Mushnick. I'm sure it was warranted, whatever it was. I think it had to do with Owen Hart and the wrongful death suit that his widow brought against WWE. And just, it had to do with that case. It had to do with that situation. This was several months after Owen died. I have the article somewhere because I know I have a scrapbook buried somewhere with all my old articles. So it is somewhere. It's not online. I don't have it right now. But I did receive my very first piece of hate mail in response to that column from what I will just assume is an older married couple. You know, typed out on the old typewriter, dated March 1st, 2000. It puts a smile on my face just thinking about it. You know, some people will get a letter like that and they'll be very upset, you know, or it'll bother them that somebody took the time to write such a nasty letter and didn't like what they wrote and they would feel compelled to respond. These people desperately wanted me to respond. You know, even at the end of the letter, we you know, very much await your response. And I thought the best way to get back at two people like that is just to ignore them and not to respond. So I never did write back. But I posted part of the letter. It's not the entire letter. It's kind of the first little part of it and then the very end. And I put it up on Twitter and our Facebook fan page. So if you haven't seen it, you want to check it out, go check it out. It's kind of funny, actually. I'm very proud of that hate mail. 15 years ago, I got that letter. I was getting hate mail 15 years ago. Man, been doing this for a while. It was a major passing in the world of pro wrestling this past week. One of the most famous and influential figures in the history of pro wrestling, Vern Gagne, dead at the age of 89. Best known not only for being a world champion, he was a very successful wrestler, but for founding and running his own promotion, the AWA, the American Wrestling Association, from about 1960 all the way to 1991. It kind of died a death there at the end, but for several decades, Vern Gagne was the star of and the head of the AWA, and also very well known and well regarded as a trainer. You know, you hear stories of some of those old camps in the frigid Minnesota cold, which, by the way, is where WrestleMania may be taking place in the next couple of years, the frigid Minnesota cold, so get ready for that. But he would train guys in a barn that he owned on his property, and guys were just dropping like flies on day one. You know, those classic stories of him working these guys to the bone, almost like torture, and guys just dropping out left and right. You know, you had to be double tough to survive one of Vern Gagne's camps in Minnesota. But he trained guys like Ric Flair, Ole Anderson, Baron Von Raschke, the Iron Sheik, Bob Backlund, Kurt Hennig, Ricky Steamboat. I mean, some big, big names in the history of the wrestling industry. Ric Flair, you know, credits his entire career to Vern Gagne. Flair actually quit training twice. You know, when he started out, Vern told him, listen, I don't accept quitters, so once you start, there's no stopping. And he ended up quitting anyway because it was so hard. And, you know, famous story, Vern comes to Ric's house and throws him out onto his front yard and starts to beat the crap out of him. So then Flair came back. He quit a second time. And this time, Vern just called him. He didn't go down to his house. He just called him up on the phone and said, you better be here in an hour. And that's all he had to say. So back went Ric Flair, and he stuck with it. So without Vern Gagne, it's safe to say there would be no Ric Flair. Hulk Hogan, another huge name, one of the biggest in the history of the business. He credits his whole hulking up routine to Vern Gagne. He sent out a tweet. He said Vern told him once to stay down and sell until you hear the crowd rumbling and then start shaking, hulk up, and don't sell anymore. That was Vern Gagne's advice. So we could thank Vern for Hulk Hogan making a career out of no-selling people's big moves. Gagne was drafted by the Chicago Bears to play in the NFL, was forced to choose between football and wrestling. He opted to go with wrestling instead, partly because it paid more, so he never did have a career in the NFL. He was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2006 after selling the AWA tape library to Vince McMahon. There was no love lost between him and Vince. I think Vern even, in his speech, said he never liked McMahon, which got a nice laugh from the crowd. The story is basically that Vince tried to buy out Vern Gagne in the 80s when Vince was on this kick about taking over and buying out this territory and that territory. And Gagne balked at it. He looked at it and just thought it was a joke and thought Vince would end up being a failure in trying to expand nationally. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And after Vern turned him down, that's when Vince really started to raid all of his talent. He took Hulk Hogan away from the AWA. He took Jesse Ventura away from the AWA. Bobby Heenan, Gene Okerlund, a bunch of other guys. That core group that a lot of us older fans from like mid-80s WWE remember, all those guys I just mentioned, those were AWA guys that were just plucked out of there. And, they were brought into the WWE. They were part of the very first WrestleMania with all the pomp and the pageantry and the celebrities and everything else. And from there, it just took off like a rocket ship. But those were Vern Gagne's guys that Vince, lured away. And that really began the downward spiral for the AWA. People tend to forget Vince McMahon did not create Hulkamania. Hulkamania was created in the AWA in the early 80s. Vince just took it national and made millions off of it. I just answered a question about that on last week's show. That's why you can't really say that Hulk Hogan is to Vince McMahon what Mickey Mouse was to Walt Disney. Without Walt Disney, there is no Mickey Mouse. But without Vince McMahon, there is a Hulk Hogan. There is Hulkamania. He's just not nearly as big as he would go on to become, where he could still come out 30 years later in front of a crowd and get that kind of reaction in front of 70,000 people at a WrestleMania. I don't think that would be happening if Hulk Hogan had stayed put in the Twin Cities working for Vern Gagne, but by going to Vince, it just made him that much bigger, physically and otherwise. The real reason AWA ended up failing, though, was, and everybody says this, Vern Gagne's inability, his failure to adapt and to keep up with the times. Times were changing, and Vern was not. He was still very old school, protector of kayfabe, doing things the way that he knew how to do it. All these other guys that are trying to change the world, they're going to fail, they're going to fall on their face, and a lot of them did. A lot of promoters, I'm sure, tried different things that didn't work. Vince tried something different. He had these grand visions of, what he wanted the wrestling business to be, and he happened to be the one who was successful. But look, if it wasn't Vince McMahon, it would have been somebody else. That's why I think even sometimes Vince McMahon gets a little too much credit from people who think that without him, the wrestling business would still be in smoky halls and, back in this time warp from 30 years ago. Look, if it wasn't Vince, somebody else would have come along and did it. Those territories were going to die off no matter what. Vince, I think, just helped speed the process up. But, it would have happened inevitably anyway. It just happened a little bit quicker. But it was that inability to keep up with the times. Even Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan used to jokingly refer to the AWA as all the world's assholes. And said the main reason the AWA failed was Vern Gagne's inability to see the writing on the wall and change with the times. And that was one of the reasons why Heenan left. Heenan could see what was going on here. That and the fact that Hogan got Bobby Heenan a deal with Vince McMahon that paid him three times more than what Vern had been paying him. That was probably the biggest reason of all that Heenan left. But Heenan was the one guy who actually gave notice to Vern Gagne that he was leaving. Most of those other guys, including Hogan, they just up and left overnight. No notice, no nothing. So even with a nice TV slot on ESPN that they ended up getting, believe it or not, there actually was first-run wrestling airing weekly on ESPN back in the day. Even with that, which came after all of that other stuff happened, it wasn't enough. It was not enough to save them. And by the end there, the early 90s, the AWA really was just a shell of its former self. Guys like Kurt Hennig and Larry Zbysko, who just went into the Hall of Fame, they both had runs as AWA champion. If AWA was a lot stronger like it was in the early to mid 80s, there's no way Hennig and Zbysko would have been champion. But, they were champions there at the end. The promotion, though, was on death's door at that point. Yeah, the only reason Zbysko really even won the title was because he was Vern's son-in-law. He wasn't really a draw as champion. He had a sad ending in life, too, Vern Gagne. He suffered from Alzheimer's disease and dementia for the last, I'd say, decade or so. About 6 years ago, he was involved in an accident in a nursing home where he grabbed one of the other residents. This guy was 97 years old. He grabbed this guy and threw him on the ground, broke the guy's hip, and the man died a few weeks later. And it was actually ruled a homicide. It was ruled murder. But they never charged Vern because he was, you know, he had dementia. So he wasn't in his right frame of mind. He wasn't, you know, I think they said intentionally trying to be violent. He had no recollection of the incident even happening. It's very sad. I mean, I know people who, with their own, you know, parents, grandparents, what have you, even somebody, you know, in my family many years ago who went through something like that. It's a horrible disease. It's a horrible, horrible thing to just see somebody, you know, mentally, if not mentally and physically, just wasting away like that. And that's the ending that he had, but definitely left a mark for the better, I think. I mean, there are a lot of people who were not Vern Gagne fans. Of course, now a lot of those people saying nice things about him, but it's not as though Vern Gagne was a beloved figure in wrestling back in the day while he was promoting. There were a lot of wrestlers who did not like Vern Gagne at all, including some who have, I've noticed, come out now and say glowing things about him. He was not very well liked for a variety of reasons. There are some people who say that he didn't pay well compared to other places. I don't know if that's entirely true. I always heard those stories more about Jerry Jarrett and how cheap he was, and I think that's one of the big reasons that Steve Austin has heat, or had heat anyway, with the Jarretts, because he was paid like garbage when he worked for them in the USWA days. So some people didn't like Vern for that. A lot of people didn't like Vern because of the way he pushed himself. Even when Vern was in his mid-50s, you know, he was still pushing himself as the end-all, be-all world champion, or, you know, former world champion, whatever. And a lot of guys just did not appreciate that. But there's no denying the impact he had. You can make the argument even top 10 most influential figures in the wrestling industry ever. You can argue that Vern Gagne would be on that list. I want to talk a little bit here about the WWE Network. Of course, they've been rolling out some new programming, including this past week. A lot of things aired on the network. Something that many of you maybe have not either heard of or had the time yet to watch, but should make time for, because it's actually, I would call this more of a hidden gem on the network, is this new show called Unfiltered with Renee Young. Now, I don't know how some of the future installments are going to be. It's basically Renee Young just sitting with somebody like a WWE wrestler or a celebrity and interviewing them. They showed some clips from some of the upcoming shows. She interviews, you know, like Wiz Khalifa. Who gives a fuck about Wiz Khalifa? I don't know how those are going to be, but the first one is with Seth Rollins, and I think it was taped maybe about 2-3 months ago. Because I remember at the time, actually, Renee Young posting a photo of her and Rollins outside some coffee shop. This is going back months, so this is not new stuff that they have filmed since he won the title, for example, at WrestleMania. But it's just her and Rollins sitting in a coffee shop on the road somewhere. It's very brief. It's only about 6 minutes, maybe 6.5 minutes. It's not like a long half-hour show or anything like that, so you can make time for it. It's not going to take up much of your time. And it's just them, you know, kind of shooting the shit. She's asking him a bunch of questions. It's not in kayfabe. It is out of character, which is why I think I liked it so much. If it was just in character stuff, I wouldn't give a shit. I don't have time for that. But it's completely out of character, and she's asking him questions about his gym routine on the road. They talk about his dog. They talk about his goals outside of wrestling and his favorite bands. You know, and then they're served food. It's like something you would see almost on the Food Network or some kind of reality like talk show like that. That's the best way I can describe it. But I liked it a lot, and I think you should make time for it and check it out because it's very good. Mick Foley, his comedy special aired on the network Wednesday night. It was Mick Foley night. Cheek Pops. I watched it. I have not seen Foley stand up at, well, it's not stand up really, but I haven't seen his one-man show live. This is my first time seeing him doing the comedy stuff. I thought it was good. It wasn't like, it wasn't making me belly laugh or anything like that, but I thought it was entertaining. It held my attention. Mick is a very likable guy. His family, his wife, Colette, they were all in the front row. Noel, sweet, sweet Noel in the front row. No clown, thank God. Frank was nowhere to be found. Maybe Foley locked him in a closet somewhere. But, yeah, very enjoyable. Again, this one was about, I think it was half an hour. I don't think it was a full hour. Maybe it was. You know, I don't even remember now. The whole thing. You know what? Maybe it was a full hour. I honestly don't remember. I think it was an hour, or maybe a little under. But also, you know, again, very enjoyable. That's the sort of thing they should be doing on the network. Whether it's a Mick Foley comedy special, or even the Jim Ross one-man shows. Maybe at some point they can make a deal with JR to have him do his show on the network. I have seen him do the show, by the way, in person. It was very good, and I would encourage anybody who has the chance to go see Jim Ross live to do so. It's very entertaining. My only gripe with it was that he really glosses over a whole lot of stuff from his career, and I wish there was more time for him to get into that. He goes, you know, he waxes a little too eloquently, I think, for too long on the stories of Leroy McGurk and, you know, working under Bill Watts and stuff. And I know that was an important part of his career, but I wish there was a little less of that and a little more maybe of his time in WCW and stuff like that. I know JR did the warm-up for the Foley special at Full Sail, but they didn't air that part on the network. But that's the sort of thing that I want to see more of. Like, this is cool. This is what we should be getting on this network. And it looks like they're finally starting to roll out special things like this, and I'd like to see more of that. The network, by the way, which they are offering free to new subscribers yet again for the month of May. So you get to see Payback for free if you are a new subscriber or somebody savvy enough to use multiple credit cards or PayPal accounts to get it for free every single month. I watched the Chris Jericho interview as well with Stephanie McMahon that aired after SmackDown on Thursday night, and I enjoyed it. If you can accept that his interview style is not meant to be controversial, or no matter what they say, I know in the commercials, the most controversial show on WWE Network, because he asked John Cena one question about steroids. Apparently that makes Chris Jericho controversial. There's nothing at all controversial about Jericho's show at all. Austin, yeah, you can say that for Steve Austin's show. For Chris Jericho, there is absolutely nothing controversial about it. His style is non-confrontational, which is the opposite of Austin's style. You know, where Austin will ask probing questions, and he will actually ask a lot of the questions that you and I might like to hear asked. And he's very open and honest, maybe sometimes to his own detriment when it comes to his relationship with WWE. You know, his own thoughts on what's wrong with the business right now, what's wrong with WWE. I'm walking through the locker room and everybody's on eggshells. You know, Jericho doesn't really ask questions so much as he has a conversation with you, like two friends, and he tells stories. He's a storyteller. That doesn't mean they can't be interesting. There was a lot of talk at the beginning about the Be a Star anti-bullying stuff and Stephanie's Eisenhower Fellowship, which is the reason that she hasn't been on TV for a week. She's been traveling around the world. The Eisenhower Fellowship's kind of a big deal, and she won it, and so it's... She's going to be traveling to other parts of the world later in the year as well as part of this whole fellowship. We didn't really break any new ground there. I would say the first 20 to 25 minutes of the show was kind of a waste. But, you know, listening to her talk about Mr. T coming over to her house around WrestleMania one time with Hogan for dinner and signing everything, like not just signing one item, but signing everything she owned and then coming full circle with Mr. T doing the same thing at the Hall of Fame with her own kids. You know, that was nice. You know, stories like that I think are nice to tell. I got a kick out of it every time she would say WWF, and her and Jericho would use the word wrestling, just because her father made such a big deal about it when he did the podcast with Austin, to the point where he was like ultra OCD about it. He and Austin were arguing at one point every time Austin would say wrestling, and Austin would visibly be frustrated that he had to correct himself. Stephanie didn't care. You know, she was more laid back. She called it wrestling because that's what it is. It's wrestling. She told a lot of Andre the Giant stories. She talked a lot about Shane McMahon and how, you know, she's a lot like her dad, and Shane refers to her as the Vincess. She talked about liking the Dukes of Hazzard back in the day. Well, I mean, come on, who didn't like the Dukes of Hazzard back in the day? It was quality TV. Of course, she talked about dating Triple H and how Vince at first was okay, but then he denied them like Romeo and Juliet and forced them apart for a year until they finally reunited. Jericho actually brought up her boob job in the early 2000s. They even had a before and after graphic ready to go on the screen showing her pre and post boob job, which was very noticeable, by the way. Jericho brought up the one night on Raw, which I still remember to this day, where it was Jericho and Rock were on stage, standing next to each other. Stephanie was in the ring with whoever, Triple H, the McMahon-Helmsley regime, whoever was in the ring. And Jericho's cutting a promo and insulting Stephanie and calling her a bottom-feeding trash bag hoe. And Rock takes over on the mic, as only Rock can. And Rock dropped an F-bomb live on the air. They were able to bleep it because of the 7-second delay. Thank you, Brett. But I remember that, and I remember reading how pissed Vince McMahon was backstage when Rock got back there. And Jericho said the same thing. He has never seen Vince McMahon so angry before as he was when they came back through the curtain. And they thought it was a good segment, too. But as soon as Rock said that word, that was it. And that set Vince off. I guess Stephanie was supposed to cut him off before he actually said the word, but she never did. She talked about Ronda Rousey at WrestleMania. Jericho brought up Dana White's comments that he would not allow Ronda Rousey to wrestle a match at WrestleMania next year, which WWE had been planning on. They were apparently caught off guard by Dana White's comments, which I find hilarious that a company as protective and restrictive of its own talent as WWE would be shocked, I say, that another organization would be as protective of its own talent. You know, there's a difference between letting her make an appearance, maybe do a little hip toss or a judo throw, and actually having her work a match on pay-per-view. Why would WWE think Dana White would sign off on that? He didn't sign off on Undertaker wrestling Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania 27, which is what Vince wanted. If I remember correctly, I think Vince actually had lunch with Dana White and pitched the idea of a Vince McMahon-Dana White match that Dana could win, so long as he would allow Brock to do the match with Undertaker, and Dana White was going to have none of it. So he wasn't interested back then. Why would he be interested now? It benefits WWE way more than it does UFC. UFC doesn't need the rub. You know, Brock back then was already the biggest pay-per-view attraction in the world, aside from maybe Mayweather at the time. Ronda Rousey is UFC's biggest box office draw right now. And then what if she gets hurt? What if she gets hurt? Why would Dana White allow that? It is no different than the way WWE handles its own talent, but they're surprised that Dana White would go out and say that. So when Jericho asked her about doing a match, Stephanie just blew him off and said, I don't know about that. You know, Plan B. Let's put it that way. Plan B. That's what you need to start thinking about because she ain't doing a match. Jericho brought up AJ Lee. Maybe you could argue this is the most controversial thing that he did the entire interview. You know, Austin brought up Punk during his interview with Vince, so Jericho brings up AJ during his interview with Stephanie. And he mentioned that AJ sent those tweets out that Jericho referred to as smart aleck comments directed at Stephanie about equal pay or the lack thereof for the women in WWE, even though they sell a ton of merchandise, we have some of the highest rated segments. I'm not sure either one of those things are true, by the way, at least as compared to the top men in WWE, but be that as it may. First, Jericho can fuck off with that smart aleck thing. I mean, what a douchey thing to say. It is a valid criticism. There's nothing smart aleck about what AJ said. Stephanie tweeted something in support of what Patricia Arquette said at the Oscars, which was about the need for more equality between men and women actors in Hollywood, and AJ called Stephanie out on being a hypocrite. If Stephanie hadn't made the comment, then AJ wouldn't have sent her a tweet about it. And second of all, Stephanie is full of shit when she says that she wasn't pissed off by AJ's comments. I believe the reports at the time that Stephanie was furious, and it was Vince McMahon who had to calm her down and told her, listen, you've got to be diplomatic in your response. Don't go tweeting something back that's going to get us in trouble. Okay? Put it this way. Whatever happened, Stephanie was not sitting there with a smile on her face when she read those tweets from AJ. I don't care what she says. She's full of crap. And finally, Jericho asked her what her favorite match was, and she said it would be her match with Brie from SummerSlam last year because her kids were in the front row and got to watch Mommy wrestle for the very first time. One of her kids came up to her backstage after the match was over and told her, you still got it. And all I could think is, oh God, all these little kids that are watching the product right now are going to grow up thinking all of these obnoxious chants are okay, that they're the norm. You know that if Hulk Hogan wrestles a match at WrestleMania next year, if by the grace of God he can somehow pass a physical, and they want to pack 100,000 people into that stadium, and Vince okays Hogan doing a match, if he just throws a punch, the people will chant, you still got it, at him. Because that's the thing to do now. Hogan threw a punch and he didn't fall down. You still got it. So, there were no questions about China. there were no questions about Randy Savage. I don't know why anybody would even think Jericho would bring that up. And on the Randy Savage thing, you know what? He's in the Hall of Fame at this point. Who cares? Who cares? I thought the interview overall was fine. I liked it. I didn't love it. I liked it. It was fine. I can't tell you to go out of your way to watch it, like the Renee Young thing, which is 6 minutes long, or the Mick Foley thing, which was actually pretty entertaining. I won't tell you you must watch this. You really don't have to. You will not learn much in the way of anything by watching this interview. If you've got an hour to kill, then go for it. I could see where some people might find it kind of boring. Again, Austin and Jericho, two totally different beasts. I still prefer Austin style myself, but that's not what WWE likes. Jericho is safer for them, but he's still entertaining, just in a different way. Extreme Rules was last weekend on the network. I thought, just to give some very quick thoughts here, because I know some people are still interested in what I thought of the show, I would have done a Sound Off Extra. It's just tough. I can't do them every month. You know, I have a full-time job. There's a lot of other stuff going on right now, unfortunately, that needs my attention. That's the only reason I didn't do an extra. But again, just to share my thoughts really quickly now on the pay-per-view, I thought it was a better show overall than I expected going in, but I had very low expectations. That's hardly a ringing endorsement. If you force me to rate this show on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably go 5.5, maybe 6, if I'm feeling generous. You know, the main event I thought was a snooze fest in the cage, but Big Show and Roman Reigns had a really good match with the last man standing stipulation. They made it work. And the tag team title match, which was bumped onto the pay-per-view, not off like it usually would be. It got bumped onto the show because Daniel Bryan was not there. Therefore, there was no Intercontinental title match. And Barrett instead wrestled Neville on the pre-show. That tag team title match was the match of the night. Those guys kicked ass. That was the best thing on the entire show. Daniel Bryan, like I said, was out. Barrett and Neville had a match, really good match. Neville won with the Red Arrow. Good showcase for him. Barrett got his win back anyway with the King of the Ring stuff, which I'll talk about in a second. Harper and Ambrose, Chicago Street Fight. 56 minutes was the official match time for this match. The first Iron Man match in years on WWE television. Of course, they left the arena for about 48 of those minutes, and we never saw them, which I thought was a big mistake. I was hoping for something along the lines of what we used to get with the hardcore title back in the day. I still remember one of my favorite, most fun matches I've ever seen was, I think it was Hardcore Holly and Al Snow for the hardcore, maybe Boss Man. I can't remember that. No, I think it was Boss Man. It might have been Boss Man and Al Snow at SummerSlam in 99 for the hardcore title. And they brawled out of the building. And back then, the camera would actually follow you. So when you left the building and you were crossing the street and cars almost hit you, the camera was right there. And they not only left the building and crossed the street, but they went into a bar across the street. And the camera followed them into the bar. And now they're brawling in the bar. There's a pool table. They're brawling on top of the pool table. And then I think ultimately they came back into the building. But that was fun, man. That was a lot of fun. I was hoping we might get the same thing here. Now they just do this cop-out bullshit where, oh, they end up in a car and they drive off, never to be seen again. And then the next time we see them, they're back at the building. You know, it's like the really fun stuff. They ought to show that on camera. Why not just let a camera crew follow them, you know, to some other location? And, you know, it's supposed to be a street fight, right? So let them fight in the street. So I thought that was a missed opportunity here because this match was okay. It wasn't anything special, but to me, that would have made this match a hell of a lot more fun had they taken that approach and actually followed them. But eventually, they came back to the building in the SUV that they had left in. They brawled back into the ring. So this was very similar to the Roddy Piper Goldust deal from back at WrestleMania 12. At least there, they showed the car chase, right? Even though it wasn't the real car chase. They showed the OJ car chase. Dean Ambrose, who going into this show had not won a singles match on pay-per-view since September of 2013, or a pay-per-view match of any kind since June of last year, finally got the win with the Dirty Deed. So congratulations to Dean Ambrose. He won a match. Congrats. Kiss Me Arse match. Dolph Ziggler pinned Sheamus. This was shocking to me. I was not expecting that finish. Although, given what they did when the match was over, maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised. Crowd was big time into this post-match, chanting for Sheamus to pucker up. And the great heel that he is, instead he gave Dolph Ziggler a low blow and made him kiss his ass instead. Or at least his thigh. Wasn't really his ass. Still, the idea of a pale, sweaty Sheamus rubbing any part of my anatomy anywhere near his nether regions is enough to make me dry heave. So, poor Dolph. The New Day are the new tag team champions, beating Tyson Kidd and Cesaro after Kofi Kingston rolled up Cesaro with a fistful of trunks to win the titles in a great tag team match. My favorite match of the night. Crowd loved Kidd and Cesaro. They were beloved in Chicago. They were totally into the match. All the near falls, everything. Everything looked crisp and good. Cesaro, just a freaking beast. If, you know, they don't want to push him as a single star, he'll just go and prove what a fantastic tag team wrestler that he can be. His team with Chris Hero and Ring of Honor, fantastic. Came to WWE, put him with Jack Swagger as a throwaway team. What happened? They became a great tag team. And now we see him and Tyson Kidd, and the chemistry that they've built together, they've become a great tag team. So I'm really digging the heel New Day stuff they're doing now. Going heel was the best thing that could have happened to those three. Like I said that months ago. No, that was at a time when I thought they would take on a more serious approach as heels. Maybe not like a carbon copy of the Nation of Domination, but they would be a little more serious about being held down and being persecuted by the company, and kind of taking matters into their own hands and beating the hell out of people. That's not quite the direction they've gone in here, but I'm digging it. I'm still digging it in the heel role here, because this is the right role for them. If they're going to continue with this shit gimmick, then you may as well make it work, and the way to make it work is to just go over the top with it and just be really annoying, and that's exactly what they're doing. Cena versus Rusev, Russian chain match for the U.S. title. I thought this match was boring. Worst of the pay-per-view matches they've had so far, and they've had three, soon to be four. Part of it had to do with the stupid chain. You know, every time they would go for a move, they'd get tangled up in it or wrapped up in the chain, have to step over it. You know, it got in the way more than it helped, and also, no blood. You could say the same thing about cage matches, although I'm kind of used to it by now that we don't get cage matches with blood. But at least with cage matches, if you have, let's say, the escape the cage rule like they have in WWE, you could tell a good story, right? Bret and Owen Hart proved at SummerSlam 94 you could have a great steel cage match without any blood at all. That's still my favorite steel cage match of all time. It's more of an issue in a chain match, though, because it's constantly being used as a weapon. It's a freaking chain! It is a chain! You are hitting people in the head with a chain. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. I don't even think it was a chain match. That was a dog collar match, I think, but it was a chain involved. I think of Roddy Piper and Greg Valentine from the first Starrcade. You know, hitting Piper in the side of the head with the chain and busting his eardrum, blood all over the place. Like, to me, that's how a chain match should be. And if you can't do the chain match that way, then don't do a freaking chain match. Do a strap match. Why couldn't they do a Russian strap match instead? Did they really have to use a chain? I just can't get into it when they do that. So Cena won, of course, and they once again teased a split between Lana and Rusev. They're doing their fourth straight pay-per-view match together at Payback. It'll be an I Quit match. An I Quit match with a guy who never quits. That's a good one. That'll likely make three straight losses for Rusev to John Cena. Unless there is a way out of this. There is actually a way that John Cena can quit, believe it or not, on this next show. They could go for the finish where Rusev ties Cena up in the ropes, let's say, or he incapacitates him in some way. Cena can't break free. And Rusev threatens to put Lana in the accolade unless John Cena says, I quit, and he does so. And Rusev wins the title back. Better yet, you could do the swerve where Lana was in on it the whole time. So that way, you know, they all have a nice laugh about it. Rusev has the belt back, and they don't have to break the two of them up. Because I think as a package deal, they're so good together. You know, it's kind of like Alberto and Ricardo. I did a little review of the Alberto Del Rio shoot interview that he did many, many months ago for Kayfabe Commentaries with Sean Oliver. And it was a good interview. And even he said, you know, he could never understand why they broke him and Ricardo up when they had such a good thing going, other than there were people in the company who did not like Ricardo. And so that's why they did it. And again, it's not surprising to hear something like that. It's a company that has spiteful people in it who will do things even if it's not the best thing for business, no matter what they say on TV with their stupid catchphrase. So it's the same thing here. I think breaking them up would be very premature. I mean, it will happen at some point. And I think Lana as a babyface, she's going to be I know the plan that Vince McMahon has is to make Lana the face of the Divas division and make her this big babyface diva. But I've been saying that since day one. Once Lana drops the hair bun, okay, and lets her hair go long, she'll probably drop the accent. She'll be an American. I'm telling you, that's what's going to happen. She's not going to keep the She'll keep the Russian accent the way that Kofi Kingston kept the Jamaican accent. It's going to go bye-bye at some point. And when that happens, Lana is going to be, I mean, she's already over, but she's going to be so over, it's not even funny. She'll become what Sable became to the Divas Division in Sunny and China. And, you know, in a lot of those cases, it didn't really work out too well. They got big heads and they ended up leaving the company. I mean, I don't know what Lana's long-term future is with WWE. I don't know what she wants to do. I mean, she's with Rusev, her probably future husband, if I had to take a guess, works for the company. They travel together. I don't know how that might change if they turn her babyface and Rusev is heel, if they would travel together still and take pictures to put up on Instagram like they do all the time. But I don't know what she wants to do in her future. She's not somebody who got into the wrestling business so much as she was an actress. And I think they found her. But she's an actress by trade, so she may not look at WWE as something she still wants to be doing 10 years from now. She may want to get back into doing films, and by films, I'm not talking WWE films, although I think she just did one recently. So who knows what her longer-term future is? But absolutely, I mean, if that's how Vince McMahon thinks, I've thought that since day one. When she goes face and she drops the hair down and drops the accent, I don't think they need to change her name. She could still be Lana. She's going to be huge. Huge. But I still hate to see them break up her and Rusev right now. The moment they do that, they take away Rusev's woman. And if he loses to Cena, he becomes a three-time loser. You know, it's like, I don't like this guy's future. I really, I don't know. Three straight losses to John Cena and he loses the girl. I'd say not looking too good for Mr. Rusev if that's what ends up happening. But I told you this last year. I told you that Rusev was being groomed to hit a brick wall. And the name of that brick wall was John Cena. And after that, it would all be downhill for the guy. And we're seeing that right before our very eyes. And it sucks, too, because I know some people don't like him, but I actually think Rusev is pretty good. And still has some of the best theme music in the company. Nikki Bella beat Naomi to retain her Divas title. Big mistake. I would have switched the title here. Naomi is now wearing boots that light up. Brought back memories of the old LA Gear sneakers back in the day. I once convinced my mother to buy me a pair of Nike pumps for $90. $89.99 those fucking things cost. Figuring they would make me jump higher. In case you were wondering, they did not work. Roman Reigns and The Big Show, last man standing. This was the second best thing on the entire show after the tag team title match. Credit where credit is due. Both guys, including Big Show, they were, I thought, very smart with young Roman here. Because the first thing Roman Reigns did early in the match was he went under the ring and pulled out the biggest babyface in all of WWE, the table. No matter what kind of match you're having, the people want to see tables. That's all they chant for. So, smartly, they had Roman Reigns pull out the table, so naturally he got a big reaction every time he teased it. And Big Show would take the table, he would break it, and he would get booed. Finish had Roman Reigns spearing Big Show off the American announce table and down through the Spanish announce desk. Reigns then overturned the American table onto the Big Show, trapping him underneath, under the weight of the 1,000-pound table, I'm sure. And Big Show was unable to recover before the count of 10. And Roman Reigns won. So good job by both guys, but for the love of God, I don't ever need to see this match ever again. Please let this be the end. And the main event was Seth Rollins and Randy Orton in a cage for the WWE title. Kane as the guardian of the gates and the galaxy. Why not? I thought this match was a snoozer. There was no reason for this to be contested inside of a steel cage. Kane ended up getting involved, as we all knew he would. And it ended with Orton using an RKO, which was banned, by the way, an RKO on Kane, and then Seth using an SKO, as he called it, on Orton for the win. So Rollins wins with the fuck finish, which means, of course, there must be a rematch. And rematch they will. Like I said, better show overall than I thought going in, but I cannot go higher than 6 out of 10 at the most. Monday Night Raw was live from Green Bay, Wisconsin. On Monday night, we got the return, for the first time in 5 years, of the King of the Ring tournament. Last tournament was won by Sheamus back in 2010. Remember the deer antlers? Yeah, that didn't work out too well for poor Sheamus. In fact, Sheamus, who was doing pretty well for himself back then, went on a losing streak after winning the King of the Ring that year. So the King of the Ring, for a period of time there, had turned into the Intercontinental title, where winning it was actually a detriment to your career. In fact, I think it was William Regal who won it maybe in 09, and I think, and maybe my timetable is off here, but I think it wasn't long after Regal won King of the Ring that he got popped for a wellness violation and he was gone for a while. So, you know, at least for that small period there, winning King of the Ring was not exactly a good thing for your career. With Bad News Barrett, he's already been on a losing streak for months and months and months and years, really, when you think about it. So he can't go anywhere but up from here. As far as the King of the Ring stuff, doing it, you know, I'm torn. On the one hand, I was happy to see it brought back, even though it was used like garbage the last time we saw it. I've been a big proponent of bringing back the King of the Ring for years now, especially now with the network. They could do it as a network special. And that's kind of what they did here. They gave us the first round matches on Raw. The semifinals and finals they did as a live special on Tuesday night in the spot that Main Event used to air in. On the other hand, you know, like an RKO, it came out of absolutely nowhere. No fanfare, no nothing. Would have been nice to kind of build up some interest, I think, with a little more advance notice. Maybe do some qualifying matches. I heard the original plan was to stretch the tournament out as a series of network specials, not just one over the course of a few weeks, but as always with this company, plans change. That being said, I liked it. I'm a mark for tournaments. I like the King of the Ring. It was a great way to get Neville even more over. The new sensation, Neville. Got to get it right here. He's the man that gravity forgot, the new sensation. And I liked what they did with Neville. I did. He had a great match with Luke Harper on Raw. Best match on the entire show, I thought. Two totally different styles. They meshed very well together. Harper, in a way, you know what Harper kind of reminds me of? He's not as big or even necessarily as rough as Vader was back in the day. But there's like a little bit of Vader, I think, in Luke Harper. In that when Luke Harper is in there with the right opponent, and I think immediately to Dolph Ziggler, the match they had at TLC last year, that freaking match on Raw where Luke Harper was throwing Daniel Bryan on top of his head. It's no wonder Bryan is out of action now. I blame that match, which is actually not even Luke Harper's fault. I'm sure Daniel Bryan told him to do it. But when I think of Luke Harper, he may be the closest thing to a Big Van Vader that we have in WWE. He's a rough guy, you know. He does not handle you with kid gloves when you're in there. And he's also a big guy. Again, not as big as Vader. Doesn't look like Vader, physique-wise or gear-wise. But he may be the closest thing we have to a Big Van Vader type in WWE. Very underrated. Deserves a lot better than the hand that he's been dealt over the last several months since he broke up from the Wyatt family. But I think also why he reminds me of Vader is that Vader was very good, I felt, in there with smaller guys. Now, to be fair, there weren't a lot of guys on the WCW roster back then, even his time in WWE, but especially in WCW, who were as big as him, so most of the guys he was in the ring with were probably going to be smaller anyway. But those matches that Vader had in 1991, 1992 with Sting, those matches were freaking awesome. And if you've never seen them before, you got to go back on the network. They have all the old pay-per-views, the old Clash of the Champions specials. Sting and Vader had a whole series of matches. The best one they had might have been the White Castle, the strap match, the White Castle of Fear, I think it was called. That strap match, and again, strap matches like chain matches are not easy to do. That was an awesome match. I mean, those two guys worked so well together. And he, you know, Vader just threw him around and beat the piss out of that guy. Harper has the ability, I think, to mesh well in a similar way with guys that are not quite as big as him. And it just worked with Neville. It just, they just clicked. And they had, like I said, what I thought was the best match on Raw. We had Neville against Sheamus the next night on the live special. Now, although Neville got his ass kicked for much of the match and he only won off the distraction by Dolph Ziggler, he still won. A win is a win. He made it all the way to the finals before finally losing to Bad News Barrett with the Bullhammer elbow. I thought that last spot was pretty cool. Barrett was in the corner. Neville came shooting in, and Barrett, and they actually showed it in slow-mo, waffled him with his elbow, just right upside the jaw, knocked him out, got the pin. Again, I don't want to hear this nonsense about how all Neville's being buried. I don't see how you can look at the way he's been booked for the most part since he has started on the main roster and tell me that he's being buried. Again, those are people that don't know what that word means. Barrett winning made more sense anyway because the dude's been on life support, couldn't buy himself a win. Now he's got the crown, he's got the robe, he's got the scepter. He could ride that thing out for all it's worth the way that Booker did. You know, winning King of the Ring reinvigorated Booker T's career. He got another world title run out of it. Now, do I think Barrett will be as lucky as Booker was? No. But at least it gives them something to do with the guy. It's not as though winning King of the Ring is a stepping stone to bigger and better things like it used to be. It's not. You used to earn a championship match just by virtue of winning King of the Ring. That's how Brock Lesnar got the shot at Rock at SummerSlam back in 02. He beat RVD in the finals, won the King of the Ring, went to SummerSlam, won the championship. That's how it used to work. Not every year. Not every year. Like Ken Shamrock, for example, he won the King of the Ring in 98, didn't get a title match at SummerSlam. Billy Gunn won in 99, didn't get a title match at SummerSlam. They were kind of in and out. They only applied that stipulation when it was convenient for them to do so. But now it's just a gimmick. You know, they dust off when they need it, and it gives somebody like Wade Barrett something to do. I like the live special, you know, the whole handling of it. They had nothing but King of the Ring matches, very little filler. They gave each guy promo time before each match. The only drawback I thought of this tournament overall was the length of the matches. They had an hour on Tuesday night for three matches, the semifinals and the finals, and not one of them went longer than maybe 7 or 8 minutes. You know, that was the problem. This whole tournament, from the announcement to the matches themselves, it just, the whole thing felt incredibly rushed. But I did like it. I hope they do more things like this. And somebody, please, for the love of God, tell JBL it's King Barrett, not King Bad News. My biggest fear now is that every single week on television, we're going to have to listen to JBL call him King Bad News. Maggle, King Bad News. He's not King Bad News, you freaking moron. It's King Barrett. Somebody, please, explain that to this man. So on Monday night, as for the rest of this show, fans got to choose the stipulation that WWE wanted them to choose for the main event at Payback. The choices were Randy Orton against Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins, or Randy Orton against Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins in a three-way for the championship. So basically, this right here is every single WWE app poll, okay? Would you rather have A, gonorrhea, B, chlamydia, or C, a cheeseburger? So I think you can figure out on your own what the main event is for the next pay-per-view. Rollins, by the way, made about 5,000 appearances on the show Monday night. I already miss the days when the champion showed up on TV four times a year. I really do. We had a champion. We had a heel champion who did not whine and moan and bitch all of the time and did not overstay his welcome either. He showed up very rarely. When he did, it meant something. Actually, not always. Sometimes he would just stand there while Paul Heyman would talk. But he looked good doing it, and then he would go away, and he would come back several weeks later. You were always left wanting more with Brock Lesnar, and the title felt like a bigger deal. It just did. On Brock, it felt like a much bigger deal than it does now. So let us all remember the glory days of Brock Lesnar as WWE champion. Ryback made short work of Bo Dallas. He was attacked afterwards by Bray Wyatt, who laid him out with his sister Abigail. Watching this, I really, really wish they would have made Bo Dallas a lackey for his brother. Kind of give it a Raven's Flock vibe with Raven and Stevie Richards when they did that whole deal in WCW. I think that could work. I really do. Whether Dallas drops the comedy or not, I think it might work better if you actually keep the comedy in there and make him a lackey in like a funny way. It'll probably end up turning Bray Wyatt babyface, though, which I'm not sure is what they want right now. I just would wish, you know, I wish they would do something with Dallas. I mean, I'm not saying make the guy a main eventer because I don't see him at that level. But they're not doing anything with him, you know. Do something with him. Bray Wyatt doesn't have a whole hell of a lot going on right now. So they happen to be related. They happen to be brothers. Why not, you know, put them together? Why not acknowledge it and put them together as some sort of combo here? Not a tag team, but again, like a lackey. And I think it would be very entertaining. John Cena came out for his U.S. Open Challenge. He said it payback if he loses to Rusev in an I Quit match. He will not bother asking for a rematch because it's just a shitty mid-card title and he doesn't care. Well, he didn't actually say that last part, but you know he was thinking about it. Heath Slater came out to accept the challenge, but Rusev killed him in the aisleway before he could even get to the ring. Adam Rose beat Fandango when Rosa Mendez revealed herself as a member of the Exotic Express and ended up making out in the middle of the ring with Adam Rose. I wanted to vomit watching this, and so did Fandango. I don't know how many of you caught that. And keep in mind, Fandango was supposed to be the babyface here. He wasn't acting jealous or anything. He was dry heaving. So I'm not the only one. It was pointed out to me that we have seen a ton of distractions into shitty finishers on WWE television lately, as opposed to the customary distraction roll-ups. So it appears they may have caught on to my website counter. We're still at 10 for the year on this show, not counting SmackDown or pay-per-views, which is not terrible, although if you factor in SmackDown and the pay-per-views, it's probably a lot worse. Brie Bella cut a promo about her husband, Daniel Bryan, before her match with Naomi. I was shocked to learn that Brie knows how to say anything other than, "Come on, Nikki," over and over again. I don't know which twin popped out of the womb first, and I really don't have any interest in finding out, but I can imagine Nikki coming out last with baby Brie, shouting, "Come on, Nikki, come on, Nikki." Naomi beat Brie, by the way, 3 minutes and 37 seconds on the Divas stopwatch, so much for Give Divas a Chance. Damian Sandow came out in street clothes for a promo. No gimmicks, no comedy, just a serious, well-delivered, well-spoken promo that tells me this guy really could be something, but they will never give him a real chance. It's just not going to happen. If they had any balls, okay, I will say this right now. If they had any balls, they would have Sandow accept Cena's open challenge sometime after payback, and have him be the one to beat John Cena for the U.S. title and avenge that Money in the Bank loss to John Cena last year that pretty much killed him dead until the Mizdow stuff came along. That's what they would do if they had any balls. Because this guy has something, but I feel like they don't know what to do with it, and they just look at him at a certain level and they think, why bother? Why bother investing that much time in somebody who's only going to get to a certain level? That I think, is kind of the attitude that they have here, and it's a flawed attitude. Because I watched this guy on Monday night, and I thought to myself, man, you know, this guy really could have something here. If only the right people saw that. Axelmania came out to interrupt, and for a fleeting moment, I thought they were actually going to run with the Macho Mandow idea I mentioned on the podcast last week. But alas, they did battle instead, ending with Sandow dropping the Kobito Akiet elbow of disdain, followed by a Hogan leg drop. I think the two of them had a match on SmackDown, but if it happened on SmackDown, it didn't happen. They'll probably rematch them on Raw anyway. And the main event, Randy Orton and Roman Reigns beat Kane and Seth Rollins. Almost 20 minutes they gave this match. They couldn't have given some of that time to the King of the Ring matches. I mean, really. Match deteriorated when Rollins accidentally drop-kicked Kane out of the ring and then did a tope out of the ring and hit Kane. Well, not exactly. He fell short, but the idea was that he struck Kane, and then Kane lost his mind. He hurled J&J security over the announce desks. He attacked Seth Rollins. Superman punch by Reigns, RKO by Orton. Rollins was down for the count. That's when Kane announced, per the fan brainwashing, or the vote, I'm sorry, that it would be a three-way payback for the championship. And, you know, it's a weird deal because I actually kind of like the Kane character right now. Don't shoot me for saying that. I do. I kind of like Kane right now in this role. You could tell it's in the end he's going babyface and putting the mask back on. And once he does that, and I said this weeks ago, once the mask goes back on and the wig and all that, people are going to go nuts for the guy. It's just a matter of time. So even though I like that, and I do like Kane kind of in that role, this whole authority storyline, it's just, it's doing nothing for me. It's just yawn, gag, snore with the authority. I like the King of the Ring stuff on this show, even though it was way too short. And the Sandow promo, but that's pretty much it.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week. The roar of the crowd, shove your feet to the ground, kick
NXT this week opened with the NXT champion Kevin Owens coming out to call out Sami Zayn, who did that insane dive onto him last week. Instead, the general manager, William Regal, came out, and Sami Zayn did eventually come out. Regal came out to announce that there would be a match for the championship at TakeOver, which is the next special, May 20th, NXT TakeOver Unstoppable is what they are calling it, between Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. Kevin Owens did not like the fact that this would be a championship match. According to him, Sami Zayn has done nothing to earn a championship rematch, and so he would not accept that part of the bout. He would gladly fight him. And then Sami Zayn basically bitched him out and coerced Kevin Owens into accepting the championship stipulation. So that match is official for TakeOver on May 20th. Backstage, a couple of segments later, Regal already had a contract drawn up for the match. A very efficient general manager is William Regal. Alex Riley interrupted, and he told Regal that he knows he can beat Kevin Owens if he just has one more match. This fucking guy, he doesn't learn. He is a two-time loser. Fair and square, he lost to Kevin Owens. How many matches are you supposed to give this guy? Why would I want to see them for a third time? At some point, I start to feel sorry for the guy. Like, at first, it was fun to see him get his ass kicked. But then after a while, it doesn't become fun. It just becomes kind of uncomfortable, and I start to feel guilty about these feelings of joy in watching Alex Riley get his ass handed to him. Sami Zayn offered to give Riley someone to wrestle later in the show, and Riley was a bit sassy towards Sami Zayn. And so Regal made the match, Sami Zayn against Alex Riley in the main event. We had Big Kaz and Enzo come on out to the delight of the Full Sail crowd. They wrestled the tag team champions, Blake and Murphy, non-title match, and beat the tag team champions when Big Kaz launched his little buddy from orbit off the top rope, down for the splash and the pin. Spoiler here, although I think you could pretty much figure this out on your own. They will meet for the tag team titles at TakeOver on May 20th. Backstage, Bayley was very perturbed that somebody had stolen her t-shirt and her headbands. And when she left to go look for the culprit, Emma showed up with the stolen property. Well, at least they didn't still have the tags on them, so Emma should be okay. Dana Brooke, her second match here, a little bit better than her first. She wrestled Bayley. She beat Bayley with her snowplow finish after Emma walked out and distracted Bayley with her stolen merchandise. William Regal announced that Tyler Breeze, Hideo Itami, and Finn Balor will have a triple threat match at TakeOver to determine the new number one contender for the NXT Championship. So, hey, all you new network subscribers, that match alone is going to be worth the $0 and 0 cents that you're paying for your network subscription in the month of May. So get on that. This has match of the year potential right here. Hideo Itami pinned Adam Rose. Why Adam Rose was back on NXT, I have no idea, but thankfully he lost. He got kicked in the face. Becky Lynch beat Sarah Dawson by submission with a wicked-looking armbar. Becky Lynch has one of the best one of the best finishers anywhere in the entire company. It's an armbar, but it looks awesome. It actually looks like it hurts, as most finishers should look. Take note, John Cena. Sarah Dawson is actually an indie wrestler. Crazy Mary Dobson, you may have heard of her. She's been on WWE TV a bunch of times before. I do believe she was, and this may have been the most recent time she was on TV, she was on Raw. She was the female concession stand manager that was yelling at Kane when they did the Concessions Kane storyline on TV. I do miss Concessions Kane, actually. That could be a gimmick for him to go back to at some point. Rhino issued a challenge to Baron Corbin, so it appears they are in fact going to feud, the two of those guys. I figured as much after I saw them work a match at the San Jose State show WrestleMania weekend. The vignette they aired for Baron Corbin earlier in the show made him out to very much be a heel, which is kind of weird, as it's the first time he's been portrayed as a heel on TV, with no real explanation for the personality change, other than he was just acting like a bit of a douche in the promo. But again, it's developmental, and so things change on a dime, they get different ideas, it's just how it is. Main event was Sami Zayn and Alex Riley. Kevin Owens joined the NXT commentary team for this match and did his best Solomonster impersonation. He chastised the announcers at one point for not calling the frickin' match, and then he spent the next several minutes openly mocking Alex Riley for his fake rage. What exactly is Riley so angry about anyway? I don't think he ever really explained that. He had the cushy gig as an announcer, and then he wanted to wrestle again, and Regal gave him his chance to do so. And now he's a wrestler again, just like he wanted to be. He should be happy. Instead, he's full of rage. That's not healthy. Owens ended up attacking Zayn in the aisleway for the DQ, so Riley loses again. For good measure, Kevin Owens then gave Alex Riley an apron powerbomb before leaving. On Twitter, Riley is claiming he's scheduled for surgery on Thursday, which, unless he's got some other legit injury that he actually is having surgery for, and they're just attributing it to this angle here, this is all part of the storyline. He's not actually hurt as a result of this. I say take all the time you need, Alex. Take all the time you need. You'll be in the hospital. They have counselors there who can actually help you with all that rage. We're just going to keep things rolling along here. We're going to talk a little bit of TNA news. Now, I did not see Impact again. This is the second week in a row I have not had time to see Impact. And in my defense, there is a lot of stuff, unfortunately, going on that I wish was not going on. I don't want to say anything about it right now. That's kind of why I asked you guys to just keep us in your prayers and your thoughts here, because we could use a lot of good energy and good karma right about now. So there's more important things that I've been dealing with, and Impact is the sacrificial lamb until I have time to get back to watching it, just because, you know, I watch Raw, you know, because I review that obviously every week, good, bad, or indifferent. NXT and Lucha Underground are my two favorite shows, and so everything else is just kind of on the periphery. It's not as urgent, and so I have not yet seen Impact this week, but I do hope to do so. But there was a big story. And that involves Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins fame has joined TNA Wrestling as, and this is his new title, he is the Senior Producer of Creative and Talent Development. And in the position, the press release said that Corgan will develop characters and create storylines for TNA's flagship program, Impact Wrestling, as well as other TNA programming. I would love to know what that other programming actually is. But he is in the fold, and that is his official title. They got some real big publicity out of it. Big story in Esquire, big story in Variety, or at least on the Variety website. So TNA getting mainstream publicity for the first time in many, many years, probably since they brought in Pac-Man Jones for the first time. And even then, that was not as big of a story as this is. I said online when I first heard the story, I hope Corgan got his money up front. I hear TNA has had some issues with that sort of thing of late. Makes me kind of wonder here if this could be the prelude to something bigger. There's been a lot of rumors about TNA over the years being up for sale, shopped around. There was a meeting at one point that was held with, was it Toby Keith, I think. and I do believe this actually happened, and TNA would have been sold to Toby Keith, or a group involving Toby Keith, that Jeff Jarrett may have been involved as well. But what caused the whole thing to break down was the insistence by Bob Carter that his daughter Dixie still be, I guess, included as an on-air character, which she was at the time, and I guess kind of as a way almost to save face, to kind of keep her as part of things. And that's when Toby Keith and all those guys walked away and said, the hell with this, we're not interested. So there have been times over the years where TNA has seemingly been up for grabs, or they've come very close to making some kind of deal, and it always fell apart, or they backed off, and things happened. And Billy Corgan's name popped up a few times as well, because he popped up at TNA offices in Nashville, and people didn't know why, and maybe they were looking for an investment stake, or they were going to sell to him, and it was always denied. But now that he's in the fold, and Billy Corgan's a rich man, he has a lot of money, he's a huge wrestling fan, has been for many years, going back to the old ECW days, he would make appearances there for Paul Heyman. It makes me wonder if this could be a prelude to Corgan buying the company from the Carters at some point in the near future. You know, creative has not really been their problem of late, so if that's going to be Billy Corgan's primary role, I'd actually be a little worried. Not that Corgan would have terrible ideas, but, and again, I haven't watched Impact the last couple of weeks, but recently, Impact creatively has been fine. It's actually been a pretty damn good show. There's just no life to it. There's no buzz. The wrestling can be good to great, depending on who's in the ring. But creative lately has not been the problem. So now they bring him in to almost like head creative, and it actually worries me a little bit, because that's not the problem area for TNA right now. That's kind of the least of their problems. To me, there's got to be more to this than meets the eye. So that's something I would keep an eye out for in the months ahead. If Billy Corgan's involvement right now in the position he's in turns into something much bigger down the road. Again, he made several appearances in the old ECW. Heyman even tried to sell him on buying a piece of the company before they went under, and Corgan wisely turned him down. He actually founded his own indie promotion, Resistance Pro, out of Chicago. He ran creative for them up until leaving, I think, last year is when he left. So this is not some gimmick deal where they're just bringing in a celebrity to get some press. I mean, Corgan is a passionate guy. He loves wrestling. And you know what? To me, the guy was responsible for the song Disarm on their Siamese Dream album. Anybody who's responsible for that song is A-OK in my book. I'm willing to give this guy a chance. It's a great fucking song. The other big TNA story, not quite as happy, but definitely a big story and a big headache for them. Jeff Hardy suffered a broken leg, and it wasn't even in the ring. It was in a dirt bike accident, I think in his backyard in Cameron. Dixie Carter tweeted on Tuesday that Jeff had suffered a broken leg in a dirt bike accident. She posted video of the accident later on that showed Hardy doing a long jump over a hill. He lands hard. The person filming, I think it might have been Matt Hardy, lets out a noticeable oh shit and starts racing over to Jeff before the video cuts out. This is not a storyline. This is not an angle. He really did break his leg. I think he had a rod and a titanium, maybe a titanium rod, I think, or a plate might have been inserted into the leg. The first time that Jeff Hardy, after, and consider all the crazy stuff and all the crazy dives and jumps and everything that this guy has done to himself in wrestling over the years, okay, like a body of work that goes back almost 20 years of just killing himself, and the first time he's had to have surgery of any kind, and it's for a non-wrestling related injury. Oh my God. I think it's a broken tibia was the exact injury. So, of course, he and Matt just won the TNA Tag Team titles for the first time after the Wolves were forced to forfeit the titles because Eddie Edwards broke his heel. Who, by the way, Eddie Edwards, from what I've read, already back wrestling on the independent scene. So why they even bothered stripping them of the titles in the first place, I have no idea. But that makes back-to-back tag team champions going down due to injury in TNA. So I don't know how they're going to handle the situation. Apparently they had some things really built around the Hardys heading into Slammiversary, which is going to be on pay-per-view. They're actually coming back to pay-per-view in June for their Slammiversary show. I don't even know why the hell they're bothering. I really don't know why they bother. TNA on pay-per-view is just, it's pointless. It's completely pointless, but that will be their big pay-per-view coming up. So they're going to have to come up with a plan B, because I would think that Jeff won't be able to come back for a while. I mean, that's a pretty serious injury. Lucha Underground, my favorite wrestling show on television. This was the Dario Cueto show. He was in, I think, no less than probably 18 different segments on this show. But they all worked. He is still the one heel authority figure in wrestling that I am not totally, completely sick and tired of seeing, because he is quite awesome in the role. So to open the show, we have a segment in the back somewhere in the shadows where Cueto is with the crew, Cortez Castro, Mr. Cisco, and Bale, who failed in their mission, which was to make sure that Ivelisse, Son of Havoc, and Angelico did not win the Trios Tag Team titles. And in the end, they did win the Trios Tag Team titles. They beat the crew. And so, as punishment, Dario Cueto is going to introduce them to the monster that he has locked up deep in the bowels of the temple in that cage. That's the key that Cueto has around his neck. It is for the cage where this beast is being held. And we have found out, we did learn something new here, that apparently this monster in the cage is Dario's brother. That is how he referred to him. And he said that if the crew, it was something to the effect of if the crew either lets him down again or fucks up somehow, he will personally introduce them to his brother. He will put them in the cage. And all you see is the reaction of all three guys. I guess whoever's in the cage like stands up and they look up. I mean, they're really making this thing out to be like it's a monster, like the fucking Cloverfield monster is buried deep in the temple here. Dario Cueto's brother is the Cloverfield monster. That's what I got out of this. I don't know who the hell they could possibly debut as a wrestler. If the goal is eventually to debut a new wrestler, and it's this guy, I mean, this guy's going to have to be fucking 8 feet tall, 400 pounds, and I don't know who that would be. But, yeah. Bad times, I guess, for whoever has to step into that cage with him. Phoenix beat Killshot in the opening match with a fire driver, which is like a standing Rikishi driver, that old standing pile driver Rikishi used to do. Good match. I'm a fan of both guys, especially Phoenix after that Grave Consequences match, which is still my match of the year. Dario Cueto then met with Drago in a bathroom, which seems to be their usual meeting spot for some reason. He says he never got to thank, or rather, I fucked up there, I'm sorry. He said that he never got a thank you from Drago for giving him a shot at Prince Puma's Lucha Underground Championship. Even though the stipulation for tonight is that if Drago loses, he is banned from the temple forever. So Cueto then goes and meets with the other half of the title match tonight, Prince Puma, who's sitting on a bench in the locker room with the title sitting next to him and getting ready for his big match. And Cueto tries to explain to him that you shouldn't feel bad for ending Drago's career tonight. You are a warrior. Warriors do not worry. Warriors do not worry. That's funny. They don't worry about things like that. You have to do what you have to do. You're the champion, and so whatever will be, will be. That was the message here. And so as Cueto is walking away, he bumps into Hernandez. Hernandez is very upset that Dario Cueto has put him in a triple threat match against Cage and King Cuerno on this show. Two men who were partners in the Trios tournament, so it kind of feels like a handicap match almost, 2-on-1. Cueto, who was feeling very threatened, as anybody would if you were approached in a locker room or a back alley by somebody like Hernandez, said to make him feel better, he'll make it a number one contenders triple threat match. So that way, it's more of an even battle. Cage and King Cuerno will have their own interests in mind. They won't partner up. They won't, team up, gang up on Hernandez, because they both will want to be the number one contender. And so Hernandez approved of this idea, and he walked off. Throughout this entire thing, Prince Puma is still sitting on the other side of the lockers. They can't see him. Hernandez can't see him. He was listening to this. We then got a four-way match, or we're supposed to get one anyway, between Famous B, Vinny Massaro, Ricky Mandel, and Argenis, all of whom have one thing in common, that being that their arms have been broken by Pentagon Jr., who was not on this show. I guess he's still licking his wounds after losing to a woman last week, which is still so stupid to me, unless he ends up breaking Sexy Star's arm at some point. I don't want to see that either, so I just think that whole thing was dumb. But the four-way never took place as Tejano ran in, beat the shit out of all of them, got a huge babyface response, by the way, in doing so, even though he has not been a babyface since coming to Lucha Underground. And then he cut an angry promo on the mystery man who beat him up last week, that being Daivari. Everybody in the world knows it's Daivari, except the announcers in Lucha Underground. And the wrestlers, apparently. Fans were loudly cheering Tejano. Outside the temple, we see Dario Cueto on the phone talking to somebody when he is approached by a fan in an Aztec Pride shirt. He says his name is Marty the Moth Martinez. And if he looked familiar to you at all, but you can't quite place who he is, that's because it is... remember Martin from the last season of Tough Enough that Steve Austin hosted? Martin Cassius? I thought he had a chance to win the whole thing, and then he went and injured his ankle. He had to drop out of the competition toward the end. It's Martin. Martin is Marty the Moth. And Dario Cueto at first thought that he just wanted a ticket into the show. He said, no, it's sold out. Marty said, no, I'm here to compete. I want to wrestle. And by this point, Dario looked skeeved out by the guy. He ran off, locked him outside the building. But it would not be the last time we would see Marty the Moth. Marty the Moth made his way into the building somehow. Maybe he burrowed under a tunnel. He ran in during the Hernandez Cage King Cuerno match, which is a bad idea. Of all the matches to run in on, I would not run in on a match that involves Cage and Hernandez. But he did, and he shouted, Marty the Moth is here! And he was promptly beaten and thrown out of the ring. And Hernandez got the win with the old Farouk Dominator move on King Cuerno to become the number one contender to the Lucha Underground Championship. Vampiro did a sit-down interview, pre-recorded, with the new Trios Tag Team Champions, Son of Havoc, Ivelisse, and Angelico, who were back at each other's throats, arguing over who the real captain of the team is. I say it's the guy who dove off a balcony 25 feet up and wiped out all the bad guys to help his team win. He'd get my vote. Ivelisse's ankle was in a cast, by the way. Apparently she legit broke it. And I was praising her last week. Remember I said that I singled her out for selling so well at the end of the match? We don't see people do that anymore, especially with the women. They don't sell. Well, it's not that hard to sell when you have a legitimately broken ankle. So I will temper some of that praise for her. Although it was still cool to see. You know, she could have tried to no-sell it, but she was selling a legit broken ankle last week. That's a tough woman. She's no diva, that's for sure. Main event was Prince Puma and Drago for the Lucha Underground Championship. Great match. Go find it. This was a great match. Drago hit a Canadian Destroyer near the finish. Referee had been bumped, so he wasn't there to make the count. Hernandez interfered. Looked like he was going to go for a spear or a pounce or something on Prince Puma, but Puma moved out of the way, and he hit Drago instead. Puma was not happy. And Conan, meanwhile, is on the outside. He is screaming at Prince Puma to show no mercy and finish off Drago. Finish him, he screams, like out of Mortal Kombat. And he finishes him with a spinning Rikishi driver for the pin. That makes two Rikishi drivers on this show. And I may be the only person in the world who even refers to it by that name. And with that, Drago's career in Lucha Underground, sadly, has come to an end. Final scene of the show is Drago walking out of the building and walking right by Dario Cueto, who is just standing there with this awesome, stern look on his face. Doesn't say anything. Dario's just staring a hole back at Drago. And Drago, for the first time that I can remember, actually speaks. And in English, too, he says, "We will meet again." And then he sticks out his black jelly dragon tongue, exits the building, and bursts into a giant fireball. That's the best way I can describe it. He leaves the building. There's this huge explosion of flame that then just quickly dissipates. I did not take this to mean that Dario Cueto blew him up, like Vince McMahon got blown up in the limo. But rather, you know, Drago went back to whatever dimension he comes from where dragons roam the earth. That's how I saw this. This was awesome. See, a scene like that on Raw or Impact would not work, and I would tear it to shreds. But on this show, like, they go into the backstories of some of these guys, and a lot of the stuff is over the top. It's a little bit out there. You really got to suspend your disbelief. If you can do that and you understand it, like, you understand what kind of show this is, something like that, it works perfectly. Like, I didn't mind it. I thought it was fine. A little goofy, maybe, but, like, it didn't, you know, make me angry or anything. You know, he went back to the dragon dimension somewhere. I don't know, wherever the fuck he went. You got fucking Arjenis, not Arjenis, you have Aerostar a few weeks ago standing on the roof looking up at the stars and the cosmos. I mean, you know, it's like a Lucha Underground in a lot of ways. While it can be very realistic, Lucha Underground is like a comic book come to life. That's how I would describe it. You have a lot of comic book characters, like Drago. Drago would be a fucking perfect character in a comic book. Same with Aerostar. Same with a lot of these guys. If you can accept it for what it is, then it's enjoyable. But I could see where maybe some people would look at that and go, hey, that's stupid. Because if that happened on Monday Night Raw, it would be. It would be very stupid. Mailbag questions. If you have any for me, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you send in your emails. Mark, from Sheffield, England. Now that there are some talented divas in the company, should WWE try a Divas Money in the Bank match in the near future? Well, that's one way to get rid of Rosa Mendez. Put her in a ladder match. That'll end well. See, this is a company who is just terrified of these women killing themselves to the point that when they have battle royals with the women in them, you could eliminate another woman by sending her under the bottom rope. Not even, it used to be just the middle rope. Now you can be eliminated by going under the bottom rope. Okay, that's how women's battle royals work in WWE. Do you really think they're going to take 6 to 8 women, if they even have that many of them at any given moment, and put them in a big-ass ladder match? I wouldn't do it anyway, and they're not going to do it, but I wouldn't do it either. You know, even with the more talented women they have coming up, let's say in the next 6 months they promote Charlotte, Bayley, and Sasha Banks. And they're not going to promote all three, but let's say they do, okay? Even with the caliber of women they have coming up to the main roster, okay, there's only so many women in the division at any given time. There's not really a big Divas roster. Look at the size of the male roster, and it just dwarfs the Divas roster. With the main roster, you got 30 to 40 guys, let's say, and in theory, anyone can win that briefcase, who otherwise would never even sniff a world title match like Damian Sandow last year or the year before, whenever it was that he won Money in the Bank. With the Divas, every single one of them is going to get a shot at the championship at some point anyway. So I just don't see the need for one of them to win a pink purse, because you know that's what they would do. It wouldn't be a briefcase hanging from the ceiling. It would be a purse. And then when they cash in, like most women I know, they would spend 5 minutes going through their purse looking for the contract to hand in before they actually locate it. Tamala writes in, I would like to know which hit looked and sounded worse to you. Brock Lesnar's chair shot from Jeff Hardy or Ken Shamrock's chair shot from The Rock? I was also wondering if you were possibly making a if it happened on SmackDown, then it didn't happen shirt in the future. Well, if there was enough interest from people for a shirt like that, I would consider it, sure. As far as which hit was worse, I mean, though I know exactly the two hits that you're talking about here. A lot of people maybe wouldn't know. The Brock Lesnar one, just to give a little backstory here, shortly after Brock debuted in WWE, the very first feud that he had was with the Hardy Boys. And they were the perfect people to put in there with Brock. Brock was a monster, even then. And the Hardys could sell for him. The Hardys were this... they were some of the biggest baby faces on the roster at that time. And so you feed them to Brock Lesnar, it makes him that much of a bigger heel. So it made perfect sense to put the Hardys with him at first. And the not the first night, but some time on Raw during their interaction with each other, Brock was in the ring. I think he was about to do a powerbomb maybe or something to Matt. And Jeff Hardy came from out of nowhere with a chair shot that I don't think I have ever heard. A chair shot this brutal. The sound of a chair striking a man's face, his forehead, the top of his skull, wherever it hit. I've never heard a chair shot like this in my life. It made such a perfect sound effect. I don't know if the chair was in some way gimmicked, if it was a lighter chair, because he hit this guy full fucking force in the head with this chair, and it made such a noise. I've never heard another chair shot in WWE make a noise like this before. It just sounded brutal. Brock is awesome, because Brock can oversell shit as good as anybody, especially back then. He was younger, he was quicker. So Brock gets hit in the face with this chair, actually twice. I think he got hit a second time, and then he took a bump. He, like, dived out over the top rope, landed on his feet, and was angry, and Heyman had to hold him back. I mean, it was awesome. It was an awesome angle. So that's the chair shot that Tamala's talking about. Now, the other one, to me, is still my all-time, I guess, I don't know if favorite's the right word, but to me, this is the most brutal. Ken Shamrock and The Rock were feuding. Rock was the leader of the Nation of Domination at this point. They were already building tension between Rock and Farouk. Shamrock was wearing sweatpants. He was, actually, I think there was some sort of, like a beat the clock type challenge, maybe. Shamrock had D'Lo. I remember he had D'Lo Brown, I think, in an ankle lock. And he got attacked from behind. Shamrock is on his knees in the ring, and The Rock has a chair in his hand. Shamrock looks up at The Rock, and he's like, come get some. He's like, just give it to me. Hit me. Hit me with the chair. And Rock rears back and nails Shamrock in the face with this chair. I think of the line from Hangover. You know, he's like, in the face. He hit him right in the face with that chair. I mean, it was just sick. It was sickening. And the crowd was just, I don't even know, like this hush came over the crowd. Like they couldn't believe what they had just seen. To me, I don't know which one was safer. They both look pretty fucking dangerous to me. The Shamrock Rock one is still at the top of my list. That, to me, is the most awesome-looking, sounding, maybe more so looking hit. I guess the sound of the Lesnar one was more impressive, but they were both brutal. You can find them on YouTube. I'm sure they come right up if you search for them. Mark from Massachusetts. Why did Owen Hart continue working for WWE after Survivor Series 1997? Also, why is there so much resentment towards The Rock when, of all the part-time crew people that come back to WWE, Rock seems to be the most agreeable to coming back? I mean, Steve Austin gets no resentment and shows little to no interest in doing any type of match for WWE. Well, to answer your first question first, Owen did want to leave. Bulldog wanted to leave. Bulldog had to pay Vince McMahon $150,000 of his own money to buy out of his contract, because I think Bulldog had like 4 years, 3 or 4 years left on his deal. He wanted out. After what happened in Montreal, he was not happy. He actually hurt his knee Some people may not realize that. Bulldog had a knee injury, and I think he wore a knee brace around that time, but he had taken the knee brace off, but there was a scuffle in the locker room when Brett attacked Vince, and Shane McMahon jumped in, and Bulldog had to pull Shane McMahon off, and Bulldog twisted his knee, so he was hurt. He wasn't happy. He wanted out, and he had to pay $150,000 of his own money to get out of that contract and go to WCW. Also, he can get body slammed on a fucking trap door in the ring that nobody told him about and get an infection in his back that almost killed him. So I'm sure he must have regretted making that decision later on. But Owen wanted out, too. Owen was not happy, and you know, Brett was gone, Bulldog was gone, and Owen wanted out, too. But Vince said, no, I'm not letting you go. Vince would not let Owen Hart out of his deal. There was a lot of negotiating between the two sides, and Owen did come back. He came back with a push. Of course, that push went nowhere. It would have made sense for Owen to wrestle Shawn Michaels for the championship at the Royal Rumble in 98. Instead, they blew the match off on Raw, and they ended up feuding Owen with Triple H over the European title. I don't know if that's what they promised Owen, but that's what they did. And again, it's one of those what-if questions, because they had already done two matches on pay-per-view with Undertaker and Shawn Michaels in 97, both of which were fantastic. The last one being that Hell in a Cell, right, that Shawn won. And then Shawn went on, and he won the championship. So it would have made sense to move on from there. Undertaker was clearly going to be feuding with Kane, so they were working their way up to that point. They did the title match, the casket match at the Rumble, with Kane screwing Undertaker, I guess to put heat on that feud. So that aspect of it makes sense. But they didn't have to do a third Undertaker-Shawn Michaels match. Had they not done that match, they could have easily done Shawn and Owen. And guess what? Had it not been a casket match, Shawn Michaels never would have landed back first on the casket and broken his back and had to leave for 4 years. So it's another one of those, we come across these every now and then, like, what if? What if they did what seemed to be more of the sensible thing, and they zigged instead of zagging, and what effect would that have had long-term on WWE? What effect long-term would it have had Shawn Michaels not gotten hurt, and he would have kept on going? You know, would he have not put over Steve Austin at WrestleMania? Would he, you know, would he have had a negative effect on WWE's rise during the Attitude Era? I mean, there's no way of knowing. It's all conjecture. It's all what if. I think things worked out pretty well for both sides. Shawn went away. He healed up. He came back. He found God. And he went on to have some of the best matches of his career in the second half. He had a very different second half than he did a first half. So I think in that respect, it worked out well. But Owen absolutely wanted out. And Vince just said, no, I'm not letting you out. You have a long-term contract and you're not going anywhere. I'm not letting you go to WCW with Brett and with Davey Boy so that you guys can reform the Hart Foundation. And Anvil, too. Anvil went, but he did not let Owen go. As far as the resentment towards The Rock, I've talked about this on the podcast before. It's stupid. It's a bunch of jealous wrestlers and fans who just, you know, don't know any better. And it's true. People should get on Steve Austin more for that sort of thing. I mean, I don't begrudge Austin for not coming back. I don't think he has to. I don't think he has anything to prove. And with his neck history, I mean, why would he come back after 13 years to wrestle a match? I mean, at this point, to me, it doesn't make any sense. But you're absolutely right. The people who are resentful toward The Rock for coming back and taking a spot from somebody else, you can have a certain level of resentment towards Austin for not coming back. Those are the comments that John Cena was making about Rock back in the day. How come he doesn't come back? All he's got to do is, you know, put an eyebrow up and drop an elbow. He won't come back. He says he loves this, but he never comes back. You know, look at Austin. Austin doesn't come back very often. When was the last time you remember Steve Austin being in the ring on Raw? On a non-WrestleMania show? I mean, it's been years. 3, 4, 5 years, maybe? Austin rarely comes back. You always hear stories about Austin having problems with WWE, or like WWE having a problem with Austin. They have a disagreement. Even recently, we've seen evidence of that. So it's just, you know, it's just people don't get it. That's probably the best way I can put it. They don't get it. Rock coming back is big for business. Rock is a huge star. He is a much bigger star than Steve Austin is now. He's a much bigger star than anybody in that company. He just had one of the highest grossing movies of all time. those Fast and Furious movies, the seventh one they just did, and they just seem to be making more money every single time. At this point, we'll have Fast and Furious 17 before all is said and done. So the fact that Rock can even make time to come back and do shit for WWE, they should be grateful. We as fans should be ecstatic. Because even if you're not a fan of The Rock, if you don't like The Rock, fuck The Rock, who cares about The Rock? I know Brian Blade doesn't like The Rock. That's fine. But to not understand why the company would want to do stuff with him, or this weird argument that every time Rock comes back, that's a match taken away from a Dolph Ziggler or a Wade Barrett or somebody else. Like, are you out of your fucking mind? I said that when people were bitching about Rock being in the main event of WrestleMania 28. If Rock was not in the main event of WrestleMania 28 with John Cena, it would have been somebody else, but it's not like it would have been Dolph Ziggler. It's not like it would have been Daniel Bryan. It would have been some other main event guy. It would have been fucking John Cena and Big Show at WrestleMania. I mean, give me a break, as though Rock actually did take a spot away from somebody else who would have benefited from it. Like, the company actually would have gone with a younger guy who could have benefited from that. Give me a break. So, I never had a problem with Rock coming back, and the people who did they have their heads up their ass because they don't get it. And that goes for the wrestlers in WWE in some cases who were, snitching off to some of the wrestling websites and the newsletters, and they were they were pitching a fit because, Rock comes back, he doesn't do every Raw, and guess what? Most of those Raw shows heading into WrestleMania that year, they sold the fuck out. You were wrestling in front of sold-out crowds for 6, 8, 12 weeks in a row because that fucking guy decided to come back. People don't seem to understand that. I get very animated when people ask me that question. It's just so stupid. It's so stupid. I mean, I hope those people never run a business of their own. At least not one like this that relies on selling tickets, because you'll be in the fucking gutter if you ever do that with that mentality. And finally, in this week's lesson in poor parenting, not to be confused with the awesome parenting of that mother who found her son taking part in the riots in Baltimore. You saw this on the news, and she saw him, I think on TV, he was rioting, and she went and found him and started smacking the shit out of him and took him home. She deserves the Mother of the Year award. Now, on the flip side, I was reading a news article about season 6 of The Walking Dead, which is coming back this fall, and I scrolled down to the comments section. Always a bad idea to scroll down to the comments sections on these articles. And what do I see but this gem of a comment from a concerned parent, I guess you would call him. He says, "I stopped watching after they surprised us with two guys kissing this season. It had nothing to do with the storyline, and I'm all for diversity on TV, but they could have somewhat warned us so I could have the kids leave the room during that scene." So, let's not mind the hordes of zombies tearing people's flesh off and bathing in their blood, and all the other kid-friendly stuff they air on that show. Children have been executed on that show. But two men showing affection toward one another, DEFCON 1! DEFCON 1! Get those kids to safety! I wonder if the guy leaped across his living room like a Secret Service agent taking a bullet for the president just to shield his kids' eyes. Some people are just not fit to reproduce. I give you Exhibit A, and I'll let you figure out what the A stands for. It has nothing to do with the guy's personal beliefs and everything to do with him being a fucking hypocrite. So there's your bad parenting story of the week. I can't imagine why our app in the Google Play Store is now rated T for teen for language and references to violence. Yeah, this week, our app got a T for teen designation in the Google Play Store, at least in the U.S. It got like a 12 and over rating, I think, in the U.K., with whatever U.K. ratings board they have there. Yeah, well, like a video game now. T for teen. You can get our app free in the Google Play Store. It's pretty cool. You can email me with your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the email address. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster, be one of the more than 10,000 doing so right now. You can also friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. You can like our Sound Off fan page. Just type in the full name of the podcast in the search bar on Facebook, and you will likely, find links to the fan page to like and the private discussion group that you must apply for membership for, and I will approve you. Again, some of those things I talked about earlier, like the hate mail I got 15 years ago, and that awesome photo of Jerry Lawler giving the thumbs up to our Shitty the Announcer shirt, that's posted up on our Facebook fan page, as well as my Twitter, so you can find it there. And please don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. I know it's been kind of dead lately, but I do hope to very soon get some new content up there once things clear up on my end here. YouTube.com/TheSolomonster. Go there, hit the subscribe button. Over 13,000 of you have already done so, and every time a new video goes up, you may not even know when. I may not post about it, I may not mention it on the show. It could be just one of those things that I do a video and boom, it goes up. Or I post a classic episode of the Sound Off, because a lot of those early Sound Offs are no longer available online anywhere. I think from about episode 1 to maybe 42 are just not available anywhere, except the first 9 episodes you can find on our YouTube channel. And episode 10, I have to get that up at some point soon. So subscribe, and that way when a new video goes up, you will be alerted as to when and what it is. We will be back. I'm hoping that everything will be normal, and there will be a show normal time next weekend. It is Mother's Day weekend next weekend. I don't know what my availability will be as far as Sunday goes, so I'm hoping, if anything, the show maybe will go up a day early. But I'll keep you guys posted on Twitter and Facebook about all that. That will be episode 382. So until then, be well, stay safe. Please keep making a donation on the website via PayPal. Use our Audible link and buy a shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store to show your support for the podcast. Most of all, keep listening yourself and keep spreading the word. And we will see you right back here next weekend. Until then, enjoy Cinco de Mayo. Don't forget that NXT special Tuesday night on ESPN E60. Check it out. We'll see you next week.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did-you-know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.